can we make your day?
Welcome to this Wednesday edition of Your Day and another conversation on science and research. Anna Simon's guest today is Dr. John Bellotto, Vice President for Economic Development at Clemson University and Founding Director of the Center for Optical Material Science and Engineering Technologies. Dr. Bellotto has won recognition as a professor, research scientist, and an innovator in a growing global industry that touches most of our lives every day. His research team creates optical fibers for products such as sci-fi-like lasers that shoot down missiles and networks that connect our smartphones and laptops to the world. As we hear more about his work, we'll invite you to call in with your questions and join the conversation. Your day continues after this NPR news break. This is Your Day. I'm Diana Daniels. Thanks for joining us again today as we offer another live call-in show on science and research. Anna Simon is our host today, and her guest is Dr. John Bellotto. Our toll-free phone lines are 1-888-539-8859, so you too can join the conversation. As I turn it over to you, Anna.
Thank you so much, Diana, and thank you, John, for being with us today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
You have had a very interesting year. You've had a few huge honors come your way. You won the Class of 1939 Award for Excellence. You've won a Governor's Award, and you have had a new title added to your name here at Clemson. How's the ride so far?
I've been joking to people that's all downhill from here. The first really 5 months of this year have been extraordinary. You mentioned the Class of 39 Award, so that is the highest honor bestowed on a Clemson faculty member by the Clemson faculty, that is. So it's an honor bestowed by one's peers, which really is, in many ways, I think the greatest honor that one can have is to be so recognized by the people that they serve. The Governor's Award is a statewide award, and that recognizes excellence in scientific research. So again, that's remarkable. And then with the new president, President Clemens, coming in and thinking about where he wants to take the university during his tenure, the appointment of me to lead economic development and George Askew to run our PSA activities really capped the remarkable first half of the year.
You came to Clemson 17 years ago. You've had an amazing journey already. Then you had this total amazing year. And so in some ways, it's like that journey is still just beginning 17 years later. But let's go back 17 years, and you came. You're a material science professor. Photonics was your field, and you were working with developing fiber optic cable. You were already talking to the business community about the strategic location of South Carolina and the upstate in what you felt would be a growing industry. Let's kind of go back in time and recap a little of what has happened.
Okay. So optical fiber is the medium through which all information today flows. Yeah, with the exception of the radio waves that your listeners are hearing us using, everything else from your telephone lines to your email and internet, downloadable movies, all those things, all that information runs around the world at the speed of light using these hair thin glass optical fibers. And as far as information technologies have come, the development of the fibers that enables them is still fairly young. So really the history of that begins with a connection to South Carolina, which is Charles Townes, who in the late 50s, early 60s, developed the theory from which the laser ultimately came, right? And he was born and raised in Greenville, Furman alum, right? So there's a South Carolina history and nexus to all things optical. But that the laser itself was the light source that got the ball rolling in these cases. And for a long time, people realized that you could use that as a way to communicate if you had something that could carry the light effectively across oceans and into homes. So with the laser, then came the development of these glass fibers. And that was really in the 70s, where that was the early stage of the research. And then in the 80s was the further development of that into something that was robust enough to actually put into the ground. And then in the early 90s, you began to actually see the beginnings of network formation around the United States, particularly. So I was born and raised in New Jersey. I was in school in New Jersey at that time, and New Jersey is also where Bell Labs was, or is, which was a pioneer in a lot of these things. And so New Jersey was really a hotbed at that time for not just the research in fiber, but also the development of the networks and things along those lines. So I just kind of, like often happens, you almost back into these opportunities, and luck plays a significant role in almost everything that you wind up doing, and if you think far enough back. But I don't think there was any question in anybody's mind that fiber, not just for communications, but for all sorts of other things, was the wave of the future. So being a material scientist, where we study, what goes into the materials and how to make them behave the way we want them to behave, this was a rich, rich, playground. How do you make new glasses? How do you make them interact or not interact with light? So when I finished up in New Jersey and I moved here, there was a realization, again, with the early stage of the industry at that time. At that point in the late 90s, it was something like 75%, 60 to 70% of all the world's optical fiber. All the world's optical fiber was manufactured in a triangle between Wilmington, North Carolina, where Corning had a facility, Norcross, which is outside of Atlanta, Georgia, where OFS or AT&T at that time, now Fukuoka, has a facility, and then north of Charlotte. But you had a staggering percentage of the world's optical fiber being made there. And Clemson, right in the middle of that triangle, right along I-85, really having the premier, certainly glass and materials program within that triangle. And that is what I was doing and studying. So it was perfect. And so that connection, which we take for granted now, I think, between research that universities do and connection to the economic development, which again was not really a term we used so often then. But today it's you hear it almost every day. I think everybody has a different understanding of what that may or may not mean. But I think we were early and effective in connecting the research activities of a major research university with the industrial and workforce needs regionally. And it just happened to be in the field of optical fiber. And Clemson has ridden that wave extremely well to significant national and international visibility as a result of it.
Well, you were in a small building in Pendleton, and then suddenly here is the Advanced Materials Center, a big building. But let's go back to those early days. You had, I guess, what we would call a very small multidisciplinary team, and everyone collaborated. And those weren't words we heard a whole lot back then. Give us a little background on...
Right. So so Clemson never set out with a vision to create a world-class optics program. But in all honesty, the initiatives at most universities, Clemson being no different, that have staying power and really grow and mature and are sustainable are almost always those that evolve from the grassroots, right? So faculty coming together and doing what they do best, and then the university doing what it does best, which is to see this talent, to nurture it, to resource it, to hold it accountable and have expectations, but to grow along with it. And that's really what happened with us. So that brief history is that I was hired in 97 into a ceramic engineering department, which again had no plans for, you know, a big optics initiative. At the same time, a gentleman named Dave Carroll was hired into the physics department. And again, physics had no plan to grow optics. Then there was already one person here, Joe Coles, in chemistry. The next year, a gentleman, Dennis Smith, was hired into chemistry. Then the year after that, Steve Folger was hired into the textiles, fiber, and polymer science department. So you had four different departments. You had one senior faculty, and you had four untenured junior faculty. And I think the greatest thing was that, you know, we had no, again, whether this was naivety or, you know, lack of care, we weren't burdened by the fact that the departments tend not to collaborate, you know, that universities are known to be siloed. You know, again, whether that didn't bother us, right? So we have, as I always like to joke, a common affinity for coffee in the morning and beer at night. And so we were essentially, you couldn't walk around campus without seeing some combination of the four of us together, even though we were in different departments. We were in different buildings, but you know what? We shared a lot of common passions for the science that we were doing, a desire to move that science outside the walls of the university, you know, and then actually have a true, you know, impact from the work that we were doing. And so out of that interdisciplinary team, you know, grants would come in, we bought equipment, we hired students, got invited to publish papers, to speak at conferences. Visibility grew. And, you know, so in 2000, I guess it was, we formally created a center at Clemson, an interdisciplinary center to focus on that. And then over the years, that grew. So now it's 14 years old. It went from those four or five initial faculty now to 30. It's Clemson's largest, most research active from that perspective. And, you know, today in certain core areas of the use of light and the materials that enable the use of light, Clemson has a global brand in that field.
And so this center is COMSET, which is?
Center for Optical Materials Science and Engineering Technologies, which is a mouthful and why we abbreviate it down to COMSET.
I want to talk a little bit about what they do, but I do want to invite our listeners to join our conversation. You can call in at 888-539-8859. So give us a call and let's talk a little bit about the technical side, what photonics is. I've been in the lab and you draw down these, I don't even know how to explain it, shafts of light.
Okay, so let's start at the higher level. So optics and photonics is the value-added use of light. So it is the science and engineering where light is created, propagated, transmitted, manipulated, sensed, detected. You know, so light is the vehicle that is being used to either convey information or to do work, right? So it is all things light. And that can be from what is considered fairly mature things, like, you know, you flip the switch and on come your lights, right? So that's optics. Or it can be obviously some of the much more intricate and sophisticated things, like the fiber optic networks that are bringing everybody their communications and their IT. But there's some interesting numbers about that before we get into the COMSET piece, is that the National Academy, so the premier scientific advisors to the nation, to the United States, did a study end of last year. And what they looked at was not only national U.S. competitiveness in this field, but just what is the economic value of light. Okay. And the result of that study was that the economies, the global economic impact that is enabled by light was $7.5 trillion a year. So that's about half of the GDP of the United States. So every year around the world, light influences $7.5 trillion worth of stuff. Now, that could be directly, such as, again, lights and, you know, internet. But it can also be indirect, such as where you're using a laser to cut, you know, all of the high-end cars, all your iPhones, iPads, all things I, right, are machined with lasers. So the use of lasers in communications, in manufacturing, in medicine, all that combines to be about $7.5 trillion globally annually. Clemson's niche in that is from the materials perspective, right? So if you're going to use light, that light has to either be made by a material, be transmitted by a material, or be detected by a material. And so that's really where – that's the sandbox in which we play. So we understand the physics and the chemistry of what make materials behave as they do, and then how those materials then can influence light in the way that the industry needs it to be influenced. And that's internationally what we're known for.
How much fiber optic cable is there?
Well, every year, and actually I had to look that up because every year it obviously continues to go. Interestingly, I will say that a lot of people may have a recollection of the dot-com bust and then all this optical fiber that had been put in for all this the irrational exuberance, right, of the dot-com era. So there was installation of a lot of fiber that wasn't then used. But because of how information technologies has grown and grown and grown, we are, and this goes back about 4 or 5 years ago, we are actually making more fiber now than we ever were in the heyday of those things. But in 2012, so the last year that we had this data for, there was 225 million kilometers of fiber manufactured globally. And if you work that out, that's about 10 feet for every person on the face of the earth. That's how much fiber is made around the world just in 2012. And so that just continues to go up by about 10% a year. So, you know, each of us now have about maybe 12 feet of fiber, you know, with our name on it somewhere in the world. And that's just going to continue to grow.
And as we continue to, I mean, our telephone, our cell phones, even in third world nations, the communication that's mm-hmm. been enabled is bringing the entire world closer together.
Oh, it is. And so the cellular is interesting because people say, well, there's no cable, right? But the reality of the actual network itself is such where your cell phone or your wireless device is not tethered, but the actual the information that it receives is coming from a station or a transmitter or something somewhere in the building or, you know, on the road. The information that gets to it comes from or comes through a fiber. So it's only that last little bit that is truly wireless. But everything else, all the information that comes to it and goes from it is actually brought there via fiber. So fiber is necessary, you know, for even the wireless networks that we use so, you know, critically and abundantly today.
And when the dot-com bust happened, Clemson was still going full speed ahead. You didn't see this as an ending.
That's absolutely correct. And I actually had forgotten about that but you and I have had these conversations for so many years that you remembered this. Right. So Clemson's position now as really the only university in the United States that does this type of work at the level that we do it. And we're probably one of four or five in the world that make and study optical fiber at a level that is essentially industrial. We were not, as you said, in the late 90s, early 2000s, the only players in this from a university perspective. The difference, though, was everybody was focused on telecommunications because that's where the money was, that's where the research was needed, that's where students were getting jobs. But as a new entrant into that, you know, that research market, so to speak, we were sitting there as again, junior faculty. How on earth is Clemson going to make a name for itself nationally and internationally in competition with these other schools that have been doing this for so much longer? So, you know, one of the ways to go about doing that is to find a market sector that is underserved and then focus on them and then build your reputation and your activities there. And so we did. So we looked around and said, okay, well, if telecom is already kind of, you know, they've already made their relationships with these other schools. Where is there a need for optics and optical fibers and lasers that other people aren't playing with? And so we looked at this and we said, no, the U.S. Department of Defense, right? They need lasers, they need fibers, they need communications, they need all these things. Everybody else is so focused on telecom, nobody is really playing with or focusing on the military. So we said, we'll focus on the military. And Clemson has this wonderful military history and heritage. This made tremendous sense to us. So we essentially got in bed early with the Department of Defense, making lasers and fibers for them. Then, of course, the dot-com bust happens. Everybody gets out of telecom. We already, by this point, have the relationships with the Defense Department, which are so critical to all this. We then go through two wars, a tremendous amount of funding for basic research and applied research. And so, again, Clemson and CompSat rode that wave for easily a decade with tremendous, tremendous relationships with the Defense Department that have positioned us, again, globally, but also have generated a number of laser and fiber systems that are deployed today and helping our soldiers. So, you know, there's been a tremendous, you know, kind of relationship that has gone both ways.
And that gets into this whole sci-fi-like area of lasers that can shoot down missiles and products that are coming out of the science of light.
That's right. So the use of light, again, can be anything from just flipping the switch, which doesn't sound all that high tech, but, you know, actually is, to, again, some of these, you know, these sci-fi, Star Trek types of things like shooting down missiles. And as futuristic as that sounds, it's being done today. I mean, you can go on YouTube and you can Google some of these things and you will see videos of lasers shooting down missiles, shooting down, you know, unmanned aerial vehicles and things along those lines as test cases. That is being done. And I think in many ways it's going to just continue to grow because, at the end of the day, defense budgets are shrinking. The threats are global. You know, the nature of the threats are very different than they were, you know, even 10 years ago. We don't want to, we can't, we shouldn't put people in harm's way as best that we can. You know, there may or may not always be an ability to do that, but to the extent that we can. You know, so the use of light, you know, both for offensive and defensive measures has a number of advantages, right? If you shoot at something and you miss, you're traveling at the speed of light, so you can get off another couple of shots. You don't necessarily have people there. You can project power from hundreds of miles away where the threat is not immediate on your troops. And again, you can bring power to bear in ways where people don't know what's coming. So, you know, there are a tremendous number of advantages for our service people.
Well, let's take a moment and go to our phones. I believe we have, we may be not going to our phones at the moment. Let's switch over to economic development, and we'll fast forward to the present day. And this just happened. A book has come out, Innovation U 2.0, Reinventing University Roles in a Knowledge Economy. But basically, this book has come out. It's talking about some universities, including Clemson, a small number of schools that are helping drive economic growth very successfully. Clemson's named in that. And the off-campus centers that we have around the state, including the Advanced Materials Center in Anderson County, are part of what the authors of this book are pointing out as a very successful outreach for higher education. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what that means and how we got there. I remember the photonics, the CompSat, moving from a little building in Pendleton to the beautiful new building in the Advanced Materials Center. At the time, I guess it was called Clemson Research Park. Right. And a big thing, the electron microscope, was located there. I guess that is still not something that you just find anywhere. What did that bring about?
Right. So there are a couple of ways, I suppose, of thinking about this. So Clemson and other land-grant schools around the country have a history of, and this is the 100th anniversary, if I remember, of the Smith-Lever Act, where land-grant institutions began to develop physical facilities away from the main educational campus, right? Now, historically, certainly for South Carolina and for most land-grant schools, the economies of those states were very agricultural, were their agrarian economies. And so around the state, we would have, by and large, farms, right? And we would go, the land-grant institutions, we would go where the industry needed us to be. And historically, that was, again, the agricultural industry. And so we would put our research capabilities, the farms, around the state. So as the economy has grown and changed and evolved, and we still have, obviously, those extension offices and those research and education sites as part of the PSA, the realization was, and this was part of Jim Barker's vision for Clemson's expansion, was that we are the state land-grant research university. We have an obligation to the citizens that is statewide, not just those here in the main campus in Pickens County. So we need to have a statewide presence. The economy continues, obviously, to have components that are agricultural. But now, you know, we have automotive as a major driver of our economy, and that's largely located in the upstate because of BMW, Michelin, all the tier 1 and 2, 3 suppliers. Now we have Boeing down in the low country. We have energy activities. We have IT activities. But if you look around the state and you look around and you look at the clusters that have formed either as existent or emerging in South Carolina, Clemson said, listen, as a state land-grant research university, our job is to support these industrial clusters. And to do that locally, because that's where the economy is generated, right? The economic value is created locally by the people, you know, who are manufacturing and producing goods and services. So we need to be there. So we begin then to do things like ICAR. So we say, okay, BMW, Michelin, automotive, Greenville-ish area, we need to have a presence there because we, again, are doing our job best if we are going out to meet their needs instead of forcing them to come to us all the time. So we, you know, obviously in great partnership with the state and with BMW and our private sector partners, Michelin, among others, build a campus there, you know, this true public-private partnership. But in my mind, at least, it is not all that different from what we've done for 100 years in putting resources around the state in service to those industries. So I make this analogy that some people cringe at, but hearkening back to that agricultural mission, you know, we're growing, you know, we're farmers, we're growing automotive engineers instead of, you know, crops. But nonetheless, you know, we're doing that same thing. So in Anderson, there's this history of materials, right, with particularly ceramic and inorganic and clay and things like that, brick and tile going back a long, long time. So there's a strong materials industry kind of in that region. So we have a materials, as you know, a materials campus in Anderson. We have the automotive campus in Greenville. We have a restoration and now energy campus down in Charleston. A genetics activity in Greenwood. We have some bio activities up in biotechnology and bioengineering activities in Greenville, right? So in many ways they are, or I think of them as going back to the future, right? The future are these new cluster areas and technology areas supporting the state's economy. But the model that Clemson employed is a, you know, proven, tried and true, you know, extension type of model. And so we are building off of a history, building off of what we know works, but we're applying it now to these newer, quote unquote, newer economy or staples of the economy, and that model of having these enterprise campuses modeled after the historic PSA sites around the state, in direct partnership with the private sector, and the state, because all three of us have to be at the table, right? The state provides a lot of the money for this, and they also have the enabling legislation that lets you do it. The private sector provides resources in some cases. They are the place where our students then get jobs, which is ultimately at the end of the day what we're trying to do. But they also validate really to us the value of what it is that we're trying to do, right? So if a BMW comes along and puts $10 million on the table, as they did for us to hire endowed shares, then who is going to say, well, we're not, you know, why are you doing this? You know, why are you doing research in automotive? Well, BMW wants us to, and they're willing to put their money where their mouth is. You know, that's pretty good validation to us and to the state that this is a need, you know, and it's a market pull as much as it is an academic push. So they are, the private sector is immensely critical for this to keep us honest, make sure we're doing the right things in the right areas, making sure that we're keeping our students, or doing the best that as we can to keep as many of our students in state after we have invested in their education. And then obviously the university is the middle to all that, where the research gets done, the training and education gets done. So that model of having these enterprise campuses around the state focused on certain technology sectors in service to those industry clusters that are there in partnership with the private sector and the state, that is what that Innovation 2.0 chapter was celebrating.
So let's talk about the students. And like you said, at the end of the day, it's about developing skills in young people to help them enjoy successful careers throughout their lives. What are some of the areas that you feel are the strongest opening up on the horizon now?
Well, I think it's probably best to break this down to kind of some of the existing industries and also the emerging industries. And I say that because the more time, you know, we spend talking about and thinking about economic development moving forward, there's always something exciting and sexy about new industries, right? So that when Boeing decided to come to South, I mean we're still, you know, so excited about the possibilities of all that. And that is tremendous. And companies like a BMW and a Boeing and a Michelin, you know, truly transform regions, right? And so you absolutely go after those opportunities whenever you can and as hard as you can. But that can't be done at the exclusion of supporting the existing industries that are here and also supporting and promoting the creation of new companies, so entrepreneurial ventures and things like that. So you know, things like our Office of Economic Development is one where we are trying to do all of those things, support all of those things. But where are the opportunities for our students? We can't forget the existing industries that are here, right? So obviously automotive is very, very strong. A lot of things in ag and natural resources, quite honestly, have sustained the state for a very long time, will continue to sustain the state for a very long time. And as much as we are excited about new technologies and new opportunities, you know, you have to service the things that got you here and continue to sustain us. So those continue to be important. If you think about new areas or emerging areas, obviously IT is not going away. There's a growing activity down in Charleston, particularly with the Silicon Harbor efforts and the IT cluster that is down there. So we are looking at a lot of those types of things. Materials continue to be very important because at the end of the day, everything is made from something, right? And whether that is something that's traditional or whether it's a new material that is coming out of a lab at Clemson or USC or, you know, pick your research university. Materials are enabling, and so whether you use them in a car, in a plane, in an optical fiber, or in something else, you know, they are enabling of so many different things that remains a good opportunity for the state, quite honestly. But I think the simplest thing to do is go back and look at these areas where either the Economic Development Alliances or the Department of Commerce are targeting companies either to recruit, to grow, partnering with Clemson or USC or any of the other fine schools to create new companies. You look at those areas, and there are about 10 of them, but they're, you know, the ones you would expect from, again, ag, natural resource types of things, plastics, materials, auto, aero, bio, sustainability and energy, things like that.
you've had a few spin-offs right in the photonics industry.
We have. That's right. So, right, the part of the thought there, I guess maybe thinking back to it, there are two reasons for this. One is that, as I mentioned, the team of us were never ones that were happy just to do our research, publish our paper, and then move on to the next thing. I mean, we did those things because that's part of being a professor, but you always try to want to get these things outside of the walls of the university and have some common and public good that arises from it. You know, that's a rising tide that raises all boats, right? So if you're successful, the university benefits from it. Well, then your students benefit because there are now jobs for them in areas that they were trained in, so they are expert. They don't have to leave the state. The state benefits from the tax revenues and things along those lines, and the jobs are created, and then all the multiplier effects that one has from those. So the question then is, okay, you educate these students, you develop these new technologies. Where then do you put it? So one opportunity then is, well, you find an existing company that is doing work in that area and you have a relationship with them and they're the ones who bring the technology to market. And that's fine in things like automotive where you have, you know, the BMWs of the world and 150 of their tier one and two, three suppliers. And in optics and photonics, you don't in this region. You have a few, but you don't have that type of value chain associated with it. So we looked around and we decided that for the maturity of the technology at the time, the best thing that we could do to bring it to market was to create our own companies. And again, that wasn't good or bad. It was just the opportunity that presented itself. And so we, over the years, spun out three companies developing three different types of materials and optical technologies. Some are still here, some are not. That's part of the learning curve. And, you know, those even those companies that aren't here today are, you know, in some ways are to be celebrated because part of entrepreneurship is realizing that you're not always successful, but you pick yourself up and you learn from what you did or didn't do and you move on and do it again.
So can you talk a little bit about some of the products that technology transfer, I guess, is the term that you always hear that are coming out of the university, that are coming into the commercial marketplace.
Right. So technology transfer is the commonly used term for this, but I think maybe the best place to start is to say that the best route to transfer technology is ultimately the employment of the student or the graduate who actually developed it in the first place. So when universities talk about technology transfer, typically what comes to mind is a university developed some new science or some new technology. They applied for a patent. Patent maybe or maybe not is issued. Company licenses it. Company then uses that that competitive advantage associated with the patent to lock its competition out of the market, matures it, you know, and then you have Gatorade or some, you know, multi-million-dollar, you know, success story. But that almost never happens. Ridiculously small percentages of things or times does that actually happen. The best way to transfer technology is just in the brains of the know-how of the students and the faculty for that matter, right? But at the end of the day, this all comes down to people. It comes down to talent. And that's ultimately where all of these successes come from. So you have to provide a place for your talent to go and to stay. But you know, off of my soapbox for a minute, to go back to your original question. So the companies that spun out or that we work with most closely, at least in areas of optics, interestingly enough, today are not doing as much optics as they originally were because, again, you follow the market, right? And so some of the areas are in areas of again, fiber lasers. So companies, maybe not ones that we have spun out, some that we have collaborated with that were already existent, but we have transferred technology in the general sense, lowercase t, not necessarily patents and things like that, but to companies that are making lasers, that are making optical fibers, that are making coatings for the fibers, that are making all sorts of other plastics for gas separation membranes, for solar cells and fuel cells, things like that.
And now the solar cell, there's been a lot of work on that over at the ICAR campus as well, hasn't there?
Energy, broadly speaking, is something that Clemson, well, and USC and others are doing a lot of work in. And so obviously we have the wind activities and the grid activities down in Charleston. We have solar activities actually in Anderson on the main campus. We have, you know, all sorts of efforts, really statewide, quite honestly. And that is an area where I think we will continue to have a lot of both research focus, instructional focus, and then this technology transfer focus, because, you know, energy is not something that is ever going to go away. There will always be a need, and there are some competitive advantages that South Carolina has in, again, very specific niche areas within the energy market that I think we need to think some more about and to figure out what our not only Clemson's strategy is for it, but a statewide strategy is for it, and then move forward from an economic development perspective to either create those companies, to recruit them, to provide the incentives needed to bring them here.
What do you see as some of the strongest points our state has?
There are a couple of ways, I think, to look at this. The activities we have down in Charleston at our Curia Restoration Institute campus with that $100 million, you know, public and private investment that the Department of Energy provided the base funding for, where we built this wind turbine drivetrain test facility. Again, stunning, nothing like it anywhere in the world. Partners, industrial partners lined up from all over the world, coming to Charleston, to Clemson, to study wind. So there are certainly activities that are associated with wind. Coupled to that is electric grid activity as well, which, again, the grid in the United States, the network that supports all the electricity in the United States is woefully aged and needs not just new technologies, but redundancies, and there are a number of problems that are well documented. And so the activity that we have focused on grid in Charleston is equally world-class, and I think will bring, you know, a lot of companies to South Carolina that have interests in the electric power grid in the United States. Within the Southeast, South Carolina is not all that bad when it comes to solar energy, too. I mean, we don't have the solar qualities that the Southeast of the or Southwest of the United States has. But for this general region, you know, South Carolina is not in such a bad position to take advantage of some solar possibilities as well. And again, those are things that we're trying to trying to sort through. My interest, or at least the thoughts in the back of my mind, why I like those particular topics are Clemson has unique assets. Clemson and South Carolina, for that matter, have unique infrastructural assets, right? So we have the wind turbine drivetrain test facility, the e-grid, things like that. We have world-class people, right? So we have the brains, we have the brawn in the sense of the facilities that that drive business to us. So global businesses come to South Carolina to work with Clemson to do these types of things. And that is the foot in the door that we need to have to actually not just do the research to expand and to promote, to develop, to advance the technologies, to create the relationships where our students will ultimately get jobs. And in some occasions, those companies may actually locate when they want to have a U.S. presence or they want to be near where the research is being done. South Carolina is the place for them to come because of these intellectual and infrastructural assets that we've put in place. So to me, and the fact that they are necessarily interdisciplinary, right? So that's perfect for a university, right? So it isn't just this department or this college, but this is something that all of Clemson can get involved in, not just Clemson, but, you know, USC and a lot of the other schools as well. So, a lot of these areas, I think, are particularly exciting because they really are interdisciplinary, they are statewide, and they will have an equivalently broad impact if we figure out how we want to go about doing them.
Well, I think we'll take a break here. Remind our listeners, you're listening to Your Day. Our guest is John Bellotto, and we are going to go to our phones now. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 888- 888- 539-8840. 5-9, and we're going to go to Eric in Orangeburg. Eric, how are you doing today?
I'm fine. How you doing?
Oh, we're doing great. What do you have on your mind today?
How you doing, Mr. Velotto?
Eric, I'm fine. How are you?
Let me get this in right quick. Do you see this technology eventually making satellite phone more becoming an affordable technology over satellite phone, and even in the internet becoming affordable through satellite, and you would be able to communicate basically anywhere, like GPS? And do you see this technology also being applied to, okay, like Infiniti years ago, Nissan, I guess, owned Infiniti, so we'll say Nissan, through Infiniti, came up with the laser cruise control, and I'm assuming that other auto parts became laser controlled. Will this be applied to, say, someone who may want an older cruise control or any part for a car? Will you be able to get laser instead of having to depend on the old-fashioned vacuum suction principle for automotive parts?
Okay, sounds
and
like
also,
a...
you may want to write this down now.
It sounds like a very multifaceted question. Maybe we should start dealing with it one part at a time.
Yeah, let me... So I don't know so much about the automotive side of the use of the lasers, other than in the manufacturing itself. But I think I can probably talk a little bit to the satellite communication side of things. I think there are two pieces to this. One is the technology itself, and then when one is more kind of regional or relates to the region itself. So in developing countries, there already is a backbone of these fiber networks. And so where you really begin to see, or where you have seen tremendous growth in things like wireless technologies, have particularly been in the developing or the undeveloped areas where you don't have the infrastructure to bring the information there. Satellite is certainly something that is continuing to be looked at. The problem with satellite, and in some cases wireless more generally, is that the light, and that actually is still light. So the information that is communicated from us between satellites or from a satellite is a form of light. It's just not light that you can see. But the amount of information that you can put onto the light or use the light from a satellite is not as much as the information you can put on light that goes through a fiber. And so there is a growing use of satellite. There's a growing use of wireless. But the limitation is always going to be how much information you need. So if you're just doing something like GPS, or if you're just doing something like small amounts of information, I think that would be fine. If you're trying to do a larger scale information, you're downloading a movie, you're downloading emails and things like that, or websites where there's a fair amount of data that is being sent back and forth, then the capacity of the information coming from satellites or wireless is just naturally more limited. So I think the simple answer is that you will certainly see greater use of wireless and in some cases satellite where you don't have the availability of cell towers. But they are necessarily going to be restricted to types of information that is less information than the things that you could plug into a fiber.
And we've talked a little bit about economic development and the science of light, but how about the entire global economics of light? Where do we go from here?
Right. So I think I mentioned earlier on that National Academy study had talked about a $7.5 trillion global annual business associated with light. If you break that down, about $4 trillion of the $7.5 trillion is associated with telecommunications. So that's e-commerce, internet, music and movies, information, routing, storage. So the IT side of light, which is, again, the thing that most of the listeners are going to be familiar with, that will only continue to grow because, again, the demand for information is certainly not slowing down. It's accelerating. All of us want more information. We want it more cheaply. We want, you know, we want our movies on demand now. So that will continue to grow. The transportation sector, so that has to do with the manufacturing of automobiles, airplanes, laser-based machining, precision cutting, drilling, welding, things like that. That's about $1 trillion. That, again, I think also will grow in the use of lasers, particularly lasers in that, and the use of lasers in manufacturing because, again, they're fast. They can be, under certain conditions, a lot easier to manipulate, cut through, you know, bigger, thicker samples more cleanly, more quickly, without people having to, you know, do it manually. That is going to continue to grow, I think. The other area, which is about $2.5 trillion of the $7.5 trillion, is biotechnologies and the use of light in all things bio, which is including in laser surgery. So LASIK is kind of the one that most people would be familiar with. Diagnostics, blood testing and sequencing and things along those lines. I think each of those three core areas are ones that will where light is already making substantial global use or being used. And ones where there will continue to be great opportunities for students to get jobs, for us to spin off companies, for us to attract companies. But at the end of the day, in each of those cases, I think the value of having university programs are that we do all of those things. We do the research. We do the education. We are a pipeline then to new science, new engineering, new manufacturing processes, and ultimately, like I said, the talent, the people, the students. And so we become kind of a net attractor for companies to grow and thrive. And that's what economic development's all about.